everyone, and welcome to Minute 67 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Brett Stillo, filmmaker and a future and also former NXM host. Welcome back to the show, Brett.
It's nice to be working again. I want to thank you for giving me this break. I'm a little like Al Powers or Al Powell. I'm a podcaster looking for a show, but I'm happy to be here talking about this quaint little quirky indie movie that came out in the summer of 1988.
Yes,
a quiet low budget movie. Set in Los Angeles, quirky art. Art commune Los Angeles or whatever, but
exactly
not the case. It's big and loud and there's lots of explosions.
Yes.
And
all right, so episode 67 begins with Hans contemplating his next move and ends with Holly leaving the room in a James Bond manner.
Very much.
Okay, so yesterday we ended things with Holly showing up in her best 80s outfit, you know, with her perm and with her shoulder pads and her stern look at Hans, telling him that he's at fault for giving her the opportunity of becoming the one in charge. You know, and I was just thinking about this. It's pretty funny that she could ask one of the terrorists, take me to your leader, and nobody would care. You know, it's like they don't start questioning her. They don't start asking. I mean, later on, we get to the whole thing with Ellis where he does something similar. So does that mean mm-hmm. that anyone can just, you know, say, hey, Mr. Terrorist number three, I'd like to go talk to the boss? Like, how do you think she would have explained why she needs to go talk to him? You know, and who she is?
That's a really good question. Well, number one, I think it helps that she's, you know, she's a New Yorker. So she probably has that real blunt way of, you know, like, well, I need to talk to your boss. You know, also maybe, you know, the henchmen are sort of seeing, you know, you know, people are asking him to go to the bathroom. So maybe there's also a, you know, what do we, you know, maybe they've just figured, yeah, this is a good time to talk to the boss. Though, you know, I mean, you could argue that, you know, they don't care about human life. So why bother? But,
they just don't want it being very smelly from everyone peeing all over the place.
Yeah. It's and you know, maybe the most hardened criminal at the sight of a pregnant woman might, you know, because you in a moment we're going to see Hans's reaction to
yes.
when Holly mentions a pregnant woman, and you yeah. know he sort of looks like, you know, God, why can't I just have more gunfire and explosions here?
Yeah, seriously, he's like, this isn't what I signed up for. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I think in reality, Hans Gruber would be, you know, tough luck.
Exactly.
You know, he knows what's going to happen to these people. So the fact that he's showing them a little kindness and humanity is, you know, I think it's a nice touch to show, okay, this guy isn't quite so cold and he does have a reasonable side.
No, but I think it's also part of the fact that he doesn't want chaos. If he were to, you know, say, okay, I don't really care. I'm going to be killing all these people, so it doesn't matter what happens to them. You know, he would lose control. He wants to be in control the entire time. So even if he gives in to some minor concessions to them, you know, and they're reasonable concessions. You know, Hans is not, you know, a scum of the earth. I mean, he is someone who, if you look at him, you know, he's, you know, the way he's dressed, the way he acts, the way he talks, you know, he thinks of himself as being upper class, even if he isn't, but he thinks of himself that way. Mm-hmm. So therefore he still needs to treat people in a humane way. even though he's planning on killing them all. You know,
yeah.
I know that sounds a little funny to say it that way, but you know, up until then, he wants to keep control of everything that's going on up until he doesn't need to anymore. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And a good leader knows that, all right, if I give you this, yeah, you'll be out of my hair, you'll be quiet, and it gives me some leverage. If I tell you to do something later, you're going to be more, you know, it's a win-win for Hans Gruber to say, yes. And, you know, he can, you might have it in your notes. There's an interesting, you know, little concession. It's like, we'll bring the couch in.
Right.
We're in control. You know, it's a little, but it's like, no, I'm not going to grant you the request you want, but I will do this. He counters. So he's a good negotiator. I can imagine him in some of his previous schemes, you know, doing all kinds of, you know, hostage negotiations. And he probably just is always looking for the upper hand.
Right.
Because
if that's the case, he should have thought about some of these things beforehand. You know, but well, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. So one second. So
yeah,
first of all, I love how this minute opens up with 6 seconds of silence. You know, mm-hmm. where we get to see, I mean, one of the things that I love about this movie is that they're not afraid to give us, you know, moments of silence. You know, like they say in a great marriage or in a great relationship, you know, you can go through, you know, you can just sit and you don't need to talk and everything's great and everything's like that. So it's a similar type of thing here that, you know, most of the time from what I know about movies, you know, they want to edit as much as possible so that you have, you know, as tight of a movie as possible where there's something going on at the entire time and that there's you know, dialogue and, you know, everything's moving. But they give us 6 seconds here of Hans Gruber, you know, Alan Rickman's reactions here, which is great. You know, he's standing up and then he sits down and it's important. But, you know, you'd think that the bureaucrats who are funding this movie would probably have said, oh, you know what, that's 6 seconds too much. You should have cut that down. Maybe originally it was 12 seconds and they cut it down to 6. You know, that's possible too. You never really know. But he does pause for a very long time, but we see the look on his face that he's contemplating whether he needs to listen to Holly or not.
You know?
And then he says to her, okay, go on. Like, what do you want? So she goes, we have a pregnant woman out there. And, you know, as you mentioned before, the look on his face is classic. You know, his eyes like roll in a way that looks as if he's in complete shock. You know, but wouldn't he have noticed before seeing someone very pregnant? I mean, I'm assuming he looked at who all the hostages are, or maybe he didn't. You know, maybe he's thinking to himself, you know, I want to distance myself from the hostages as much as possible so that I don't, you know, get any attachments to them. That could be. All right. See, I answered my own question.
Yeah. Also, as you know, as your classic like crime movie and real life crime, you plot, you know, you have the perfect plan, but then, you know, there's some little loophole, something you couldn't possibly have foreseen.
Yeah.
Is one of our hostages is very pregnant, and you know, I mean that reaction could almost be him slapping his forehead.
Yeah.
It doesn't get that far.
Completely.
But,
and
he just
the irony of it is that, you know, we know that Ginny's been drinking all night. So, you know, I don't know. You know, there might be problems with this baby later on. Who knows? And so then Holly quickly eases his concern by saying, relax, she's not due for a couple of weeks, but sitting on that rock isn't doing her back any good. So I would like permission to move her to one of the offices where there's a sofa. So my first question is why is there a sofa in an office? You know, and why is she sitting on a rock? You know, they couldn't find some better place for her to sit than have her sit on a rock in the middle of that. Yeah. You know, it's where they're having the party. You know, you think that a rock, that there must be some place for people to sit. I doubt it's just people are mingling, you know, by walking around and that there's no place to sit down and have a discussion with somebody while you're taking a drink.
Well, I think Holly's also maybe stressing her point. You know, she wants things. You know, this is interesting, Rob, because this also kind of ties into what we were talking yesterday about how did Holly rise so fast in Nakatomi? And she's like, one, she's dealing with a superior who she's being very respectful with, but she's also being very direct and blunt. And, you know, she's got good points for everything. So, you know, this is how she became a fast climber at Nakatomi.
Yeah.
Is probably doing similar things. And, you know, knowing, you know, just, yeah, knowing how, when, and where to ask a big shot something.
Right.
Sure. And, yeah.
So then.
And, yeah, but, you know, in reality, there should have been some comfy chairs. Yeah. And I think there's one man who knows why there's a couch in a room, and that's Ellis.
Well, no. I don't know. He might, because we know. We know that if Ellis was living in today's world, he would have been arrested for sexual harassment very quickly, years ago. He wouldn't have made it as far as he did. You know, but especially just if you look at the way that he was talking to Holly at the beginning of the movie, you know, he's already propositioning, you know, his I guess you could say immediate underling, who he knows is married, you know, come to my house and we'll have wine and cheese, you know, it's like, but then that makes me wonder if they're talking here about, you know, offices having sofas. Now you probably recall that towards the beginning of the movie, when John and Holly are talking in Ellis's office or Ellis's bathroom. So at that point, you know, there are two characters who, you know, burst into the office in order to have sex. And, you know, maybe it's because everyone knows. I was wondering why they came to that office. But then again, maybe everyone knows that Ellis's office is the one with the couch. You know. But then they ended up, you know, in a different office where they were on someone's desk. So I guess that means that Ellis is one of the few people who might have a sofa, you know, or maybe that was the only place that was available at that point. Maybe at that point in the party, most of the offices with sofas were already occupied, I guess you could say.
It is the office Christmas.
Yes, that is true. And so Hans then gives a response. No, but I'll have a sofa brought out to you. Good enough. So it's an easy concession for him to make, but as we said before, you know, it's a little bit of the give and take. You know, let's make them think that we can be reasonable here and that we're not going to kill them. You know, even though that's what we're going to be doing.
but
wouldn't that get all the other people jealous? You know, you have all these other people. They're going to bring out one sofa and let Ginny lie down on it. And then everyone else is going to say, oh, come on, I want to sit on something more comfortable. You know, Ellis isn't going to complain. Ellis is going to say, that's my couch. Oh, maybe Ellis is Ginny's baby's father. Ooh. that would get him even more jealous.
more diehard fan fiction.
Of course.
I like that. I like that, but I would just say, since I love talking about him, that we don't see him, but I'm assuming, actually, you probably know where Al Leong is. Is Al Leong guarding the hostages, or is
no,
he
not right now.
The building?
He's not guarding them right now. Okay. He's downstairs still.
Okay.
He's waiting for the assault downstairs.
Gotcha.
Which I think happens next movie? Week, if I remember correctly. I think that's where it begins.
Yeah, that's part of it. We're heading towards that. But
yeah.
In an action movie, it's always important to know where Al Leong is.
Especially, you need to know also where the candy bars are. But we'll talk about that next week.
Yeah, very good.
And actually, where you can say wherever the candy bars are, that's where Al Leong is.
Follow the candy wrappers.
There you go.
There you go. There you go. But yeah, this is it's, I think it's one thing about Hans Gruber is he always seems to be one or two steps ahead of everybody. And I think this is he's not being magnanimous. He's being crafty.
Yes, that's true. And, Holly gives into what he says and says, good enough. And then continues by saying, and unless you like it messy, I said, bring us and group to the bathroom. I mean, come on, these people have been waiting at least, like, sunset was around 5 o'clock. Okay. And I guess this is probably, let's say this is maybe 9 o'clock at night. Later on, we'll know for sure when it's 10 o'clock. So, at this point. Oh, no, sorry. We already talked about last week when, Gail Wallins was talking about the news. So at that point, it was already 10 o'clock. So let's say it's 10:30 now.
Okay.
So it means these people have been sitting there waiting 5.5 hours. Now, remember, these are people drinking at a party. That means they've been holding it in for a very long time. Because if people have been drinking a lot, they're going to need to, especially if they're anxious and are in a situation right now where, where they don't know what's going to be happening. They all might have, they might have bladder problems. How's that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I love Hans's response. He goes, yes, you're right. It will be done. So he's conceding to the fact that he made a mistake here, basically. So you mentioned earlier that maybe in previous hostage situations, he's done things differently, but he's planned this so meticulously. He didn't think about the fact that there are going to be 30 people that are going to have to use the bathroom over 6, 8, 10 hours, however long, this whole crisis is going to go. It shouldn't be that difficult to start taking people in groups.
Yeah. And I would think even for a heartless supervillain, it just would go easier. I think I think it might just be a tactical decision. Yeah, take them into the bathroom. Again, it sort of then also gives him some leverage. Like, I'm not so bad.
Right.
No, why don't all of you climb on that helicopter to freedom?
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna let you go.
Yeah. And, I think I can imagine Rickman and McTiernan, having some conversations about, how villainous do you want me to be, John? Or can I, that's where, could I take a beat here? It obviously they gave this guy a lot of room. Yeah. And I think that's it's Rickman's intuition. It's worth mentioning again, this actor's he has that sense of when to take a beat, when to take a breath. Let me think. Picture if you will, Klaus Kinski playing Hans Gruber.
Ooh, interesting.
And would have far, far different. I think Hans Gruber is a Bond villain. Let's say that.
Yes.
But he's a very cerebral Bond villain. I think what makes him such a memorable character isn't necessarily his villainy. It's his intelligence.
Yes.
It's his craftiness. That's what I think, and it's his ability to, in this movie, it's point counterpoint. It's the cat and mouse. It's the chess game that he's got going with human playing pieces.
Yes.
We know Rickman can do those great, explosive volcanic things, but he really, most of the time he's this, you know, he's sort of this quiet, like I said, in this he's almost more like a headmaster at a school.
Yeah, you know that you this know? Was his like, very
he won't,
first.
He won't even look up at her. He's, you know,
you know that this was his very first film role.
Yeah, and you know, it's a funny thing, little what we remember. I happened to be watching Johnny Carson when Bruce Willis made his first appearance.
Oh wow.
On that show so there was a little bit of, you know, nice to meet you, Johnny. Nice to meet you, Bruce. And the one, you know, the movie I think was opening that night. Cause I remember Bruce doing, you know, Johnny saying, well, I know you got to go to the premiere. So thanks for stopping by. And, you know, always a little bit cooler when the celebrity leaves and does the wave, like, yeah. I got to go to the premiere, but
I got to go to see more important people than you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Don't you wish you were me? But it's funny, like 35 years later, I remember Bruce Willis saying, oh, this guy playing the bad guy, Alan Rickman, this is, you know, like him being excited. This is his first movie, and you're gonna be blown away by this guy. Literally.
Oh, wow.
Because he has explosive plan. But just, it was like, I was like, wow, okay. So it was just, you know, like, you know, he was more excited about everybody seeing his co-star and what a badass he is. Like, you're going to really dig this guy. And yeah, him mentioning this is his first movie. And there you go.
Oh, wow. All right. I'm going to have to look, see if I can find a clip of that, of Bruce Willis and Carson.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if it's,
yeah.
I wonder if it's up there.
I have
somewhere.
To try and find that. Yeah. See if we can get that. And then he looks at her and goes, was there something else? Meaning, you know, he's acting very cordial. I mean, we know that he's planning on killing everybody, but he's like, okay, what else do you want? you've just given me two easy things to concede to. What else can you give me to concede to that will be, you know, that will be good for me until I kill you all? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And then she goes, no, thank you. You know, it makes it seem as if they're in the middle of a, you know, in the middle of like a business meeting. You know, this isn't a hostage, a hostage situation, the way that they're having this discussion. And I love how, you know, the shot of him, you can see, you know, the picture of her behind him. You know, so he's, you know, he happens to be in her office. You know, that's the, you know, and then he like asks her, Mr. Takagi chose his people well, Mrs. And then she responded, Gennaro, Miss Gennaro. So, first of all, her name is on the door. You'd think that at some point he would have tried to like look, I mean, he wouldn't care, but just to see whose office he's in, you know, get an idea, you know. Now, also, I wonder, how does this deception work in her favor? You know, she's not thinking about John. She's not saying to herself, okay, if he knows I'm married, he's going to, you know, like what she's not offering herself, you know, as a single woman to, you know, to him or anything like that. So like, what does she gain out of it?
Yeah. Well, this is where you're going to have to remind me that, you know, in this amazing house of cards that is the script for this movie, you know, because there's a lot of, I know something you don't. And, you know, we know the audience know the whole thing, but I'm trying to remember, does Holly knows John somewhere in the building. Does she know that?
Well, she knows that he killed Tony. We know that she saw the body of Tony show up in the elevator.
Yeah.
And she actually also, in the script, it mentions that she knows that it's John because that's his sense of, that's his type of sense of humor, you know, to do the whole,
yeah, it was just
stuff like that.
Yeah. That just occurred to me is right. Like, you know,
so she knows that he's running around. So I think in her mind, she's saying, okay, you know, if he thinks that I'm Mrs., but again, she's Mrs. Gennaro, even if she's a Mrs. there.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out where this deception will try to take her. I don't know.
Yeah, I imagine just yeah, it's where we wonder, you know, as human beings, would we think of this, or you know, is this just tight script writing? But you know, I think Holly is also thinking one step ahead. If they find John, she might, you know, I think she might have enough of a grasp of the situation. John's out there, and I don't want to be used as a pawn in any way in this.
Right.
So she's keeping her, but it's still, I mean, it's like, but it's like Hans is, you know, you can hear the gears in his analog mind going, and who you are and what is your, and what are you doing? And, you know, and she, but she, I think, yeah, because she knows John is out there being John. Like, the less you know about me, the better.
Right.
And that's probably also a New York thing. You know, mind your own. My name is Mrs. Mind Your Own Bad Business. You know,
basically.
So, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is an interesting. It's an interesting dialogue because in a way you look at it and say, do we need this? But it's like it shows one, Holly's a badass herself. Two, Hans has a brain like a hungry shark.
Yes.
He is always on. And you have to be, I think you all have to be careful.
Except that he doesn't notice that one of the pictures is flat, is facing down. You know, it's flat. One of the pictures behind him, you know.
And would he pick up on that? He's got a lot on his mind.
No, but maybe, you know what, as we're thinking through this, maybe that's why she says miss, because she says to herself, if he knows that she's married, he might turn around and look at the pictures, see pictures of kids, and then say, oh, well, maybe there's a picture of her husband, so let's just, you know, randomly look to see who her husband is. It wouldn't do any good because he doesn't know what John looks like at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that's what's going through her mind.
Yeah. I would just another speculative thing. I would imagine being the wife of a police detective, you get into situations where you just don't, you know, you don't talk about, you know, who you are, what your husband does for whatever reason, like in the middle of it, there may be times when in the past, when he was in an investigation of some kind and, you know, she just, you know, hey, if anybody comes to the door, don't answer the door, you know,
right.
Just whatever being. You know, being a cop's wife, I think probably has you learn certain things.
Right. Okay.
You know,
that's
I work with your husband. Yeah. But anyway, but still, it's, you know, it's two very sharp people, and that they gave these two actors, you know, this scene. And yeah, like the subtlety of it. I think if you were to shoot this scene today, the temptation would be even greater, like, oh, let's up the ante, add the tension, have Gruber hold a gun just to create some, you know, have him circle around her, do something over. This is just, he's just like, I'm at my desk and, you know, he's slightly annoyed. And,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it gets, yeah, I think it gives Rickman a chance to like, you know, I'd like to show he's not just a villain and, you know, kind of,
right.
You know, even supervillains have like roll their eyes.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
I would just like, you know, maybe just add, I think I'll hold off because I think I can wait till the end to make a point about something.
Okay.
But let's get in the script.
Okay. So the script only has two minor, very minor changes between what's in the final shooting, in the final movie and what's in the script. So one of the things is that Holly mentions that actually both are in Holly's speech about Ginny. She goes, we have a pregnant woman out there. Relax. She's not due for 2 weeks. But a marble floor isn't doing her back any good. Okay. So again, as opposed to saying that she's sitting on a rock, she's sitting on the floor. That actually makes more sense that they're huddling, you know, all of the hostages on the floor. As opposed to saying that she's on a rock. You know, like again, we see what the whole room looks like. You know, there's all those waterfalls and the Japanese feng shui or whatever you want to call that stuff. You know, that there are rocks and stuff like that. So okay, she could be sitting on a rock, but it makes more sense to say that everyone's sitting on the floor. So you know,
Yeah.
it just mentions
Yeah,
the
you
fact
automatically.
that she's on the floor and that she's due in 2 weeks as opposed to a couple of weeks, which I guess saying 2 weeks makes it more urgent. You know, as opposed to saying that she's due in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the
Yeah, you
minor difference.
more of a time tape.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that happened to them somehow related to the holidays. So, Brett, you got a story for us?
Yeah, I got a good one.
Great.
Got a good one. It's a Halloween story.
Ooh.
We did this will air the beginning of October. We got Halloween on the end of October. I'll tell you the story of one Halloween night and the best fight I ever saw.
Wow. All right, give it to us, give it to us.
This takes place about 15 years ago in Osaka, Japan. And at the time, I was in a rock and roll band, and we were touring, and we were in Osaka for Halloween, and it was pretty cute being in another country on Halloween.
Do they celebrate
It
Halloween
was definitely.
in Japan?
It's interesting. It's for the most part, no. I got the impression it was kind of like for younger, like teenagers, younger po folks. You know, Gen X kind of kids. It was like a hipster thing, and just like an excuse for kids, like, oh yeah, we can dress up and be crazy. And I suppose maybe it's sort of like, you know, Mardi Gras in other
Okay.
cities or other places,
Okay,
you
that's
know.
fair.
So it's like some people know it. It's like, hey, I'm having a Halloween party. So this was Halloween night. And so yeah, there was some, like, I'd say in the audience, there are definitely some people dressed up. And one guy in particular who worked at the club who was wearing a Pikachu kegurumi. You know, it's
Oh,
kind of like big,
wow.
it's like a big sleepy pajama top. So he looked like a very tall Pikachu. And you ever have those moments where something happens and it's like, wow, this looks like it's happening just like in a movie. And what happens? I'm outside of this little club, and it was an underground club. It was like a bomb shelter. And the local biker gang shows up. And these guys are straight out of like an action movie. They look like 1950s greasers. They did, yeah, they look, yeah. And they ride up in their bikes, and you see this crowd of people just part.
Oh,
Because everybody's afraid of these guys, and they get off their bike, and they park wherever they want, and they swagger around. And a guy says to me, "Yeah, they're the real deal. They're errand boys for the Yakuza." I'm like,
wow.
okay.
Yeah, steer clear.
And they're just kind of strutting around like gangsters do. And end of the night, I don't know what happens, but I'm kind of in a corner near the front door trying to get some air, and I hear kapow, bang, bang, boom. And I turn and I see one of these bikers kind of falling backwards, like somebody hit him really hard, and he's kind of shaking it off and he's getting it up and he's putting his fists up. And there on Halloween night, I see a perfectly delivered flying sidekick, like in a movie, except this
Whoa.
is for real. And it's the guy in the Pikachu costume. And he delivers, boom! I can't remember if he hit the guy in the chest or in the head, but it was like a straight on, you only see it in the movies, flying kick delivered by a Pokemon.
Wow.
Takes the guy out. And that was it. The fight was over at that point. And I don't know, I guess the other bikers were had enough respect for the guy in the Pikachu jammies that they left him alone. But and then, you know, that was that, and the bikers left. And end of the night, I'm ready to leave, and I see this sad looking guy in his Pokemon costume just sweeping the floor. It's like, I got to do everything around here. I sweep up. I'm the bouncer. I had to kick a guy in the head. But yeah, that was Halloween in Osaka, Japan around 2006.
Wow. That's a great story. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Glad you liked it.
I did.
I will admit, you know, over the years, I might have gotten certain facts wrong, but that's pretty much how I remember it. And it's maybe been embellished a little bit, but the dude definitely kicked the biker.
All right.
that I can, but that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
You do that. All right. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you, Brett?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm Brett Stillo, a lovable rogue. You can find me on Facebook, on Instagram. You could just, if you really want to get in touch with me, my email is countfink@gmail.com. If I don't know, I'm available for podcasts. I'm a bit of an indie filmmaker myself. I make short films and do a lot of film editing. I'll do a lot of video stuff and help me edit your wedding. How's that? So I'm around and I'm always available to talk about movies.
You'll do a minute by minute at someone's wedding. That's what you're saying.
Yes. Yes, that would be fascinating.
Yes.
To break it down minute by minute. Or that could be incredibly boring. That might be punishment.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Depends on for who. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website. And obviously, please go rate, review, and subscribe any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. So until tomorrow. Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yo.